Hey, podcast listeners, I'm going to make this short because we have an over an hour long here chat with Steve Cropper, of course, famous for his work with Stax Records and Booker T. MGs and all kinds of stuff. After that, if you're a fan of the Stax sound, I want to just remind you that over at the archives at WFMU.org/Michael, I've got interviews with Booker T. Jones and Duck Dunn and singer, songwriter, artist Eddie Floyd and William Bell. And a few other Stax-related interviews. They're at WFMU.org/Michael. So enjoy this interview. It's real interesting, real free-flowing, and really interesting guy. Great sense of humor, laughed a lot. There was some confusion about when to call him. So right as this starts, it starts off a little bit with a jolt because he had called me and said, you know what, I need to take a shower, so call me back in 5 minutes. So that's what the early part of this is talking about, the comfort of showering in your own shower. So this is me and Steve Cropper. Hope you're safe, well, and I will talk with you soon. Enjoy it. New Steve Cropper album, Fire It Up. Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm good.
And you're clean.
Thanks. Yeah, I am. I hope. I love being in my own shower. It's great. I've been showering in other showers for, what, a week almost.
Oh.
It's just not the same. I don't care what it is. Everybody says, I want to get home to my own bed. Well, the other beds were great. Not a problem. The showers were okay, too, but they're just not the same.
You don't like the little teeny shampoo or whatever?
Teeny shampoo, I never put it that way. That's a good title for a song.
Oh, there you
just
go.
Me and some teeny shampoo.
I'll take the co-write.
I still love you. I'll just take me and my little tiny shampoo. Man, every time I hear Come Monday, it blows me away, the lyrics. When he says, Come Monday, I'll be all right. Come Monday, I'll be holding you tight. I've spent four lonely days. And I know what he's talking about when he says Brown LAAs. I lived there for 13 years. But he used to fly over it. And I'd fly over and I'd look down and I'd go, look at that brown haze. And then I'd get up above it when I go up the mountains.
So are you near Memphis now?
Well, I am. I'm in Nashville.
Okay.
But I'm very near Memphis. We get down there a lot, so.
Yeah. It's kind of two different
worlds.
I sort of
moved back to Tennessee, but I met my wife here in Nashville, and she wanted to come to Nashville. I said, okay. And that was, in June, it'll be 32 years.
Okay, that's love.
And I watched this town grow from a little bitty nothing to a monster.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, I hope you got some space.
I do. I'm lucky. Just don't ask me to go to the kitchen or the bathroom for anything. It'll take a minute.
Oh, that sounds great. You know, you've been writing and making music for such a long time. So as I was listening to the new record, the first thing that I was thinking about was what has changed and what has stayed the same in the process of making a record? Like, how similar, because it's been almost 60 years, how similar is this to making records 60 years ago?
Well, you started with writing songs and you went to making records. It's technology has gone a long way. Mm. And I remember when somebody told me about it, you could overdub as many times as you want to. And I went, why? We're cleaning the tracks trying to make room for more overdubs, you know.
Mm.
And the engineer's name was Gordon Rudd that told me that. And I couldn't believe it. And I worked with him out in L.A. and barred him. I had him flown in the Stax. And Jim offered him a job. I said, okay. And he took it. That's pretty cool.
Mm.
Gordon Rudd.
How many years were you not overdubbing at Stax?
How many years? I don't know. I know Midnight Hour was overdubbed on, but they flew Al Jackson up to do a backbeat on it. What year was it? 63 or something like with Wilson Pickett, Midnight Hour.
Yeah.
Before that, there was none. And Stax, what was... We had a two-track and there was no overdubs, except that, so Dock of the Bay was mixed on 4+2, that's 6 tracks. So I had the Waves and the Seagulls on separate tracks.
So when you're making your new record, Fire It Up, do you try to keep the overdubs to a minimum, or is that new, you know, you got the...
No, well, yeah, my overdubs were basically bounced down to one guitar track for the lead stuff. And I think the rhythm stuff was also one track at John's house. So most of those tracks were cut. I would say most of them, all of them, I think, were cut at John Tiven's house studio. So the band was never in a room together. And so John had access to all of these tracks that we had written for another project that was turned down. And so I just forgot about the songs and went on to something else, you know, went on to other things and really had forgotten about them. And John says, you know, I still have access to all these tracks. I've been working on some of them. I said, you know, we're going to need a singer because I can't sing all those things. I can't sing any of them. So Roger Rio came through like gangbusters. Hmm. So I said, we're going to need a singer. And John says, I think I got one. I said, well, you better send me something you sung on. And he said, well, I've got one back from him on one of our songs. I said, well, send it to him. And he did. And I called him back. I said, where's this guy been? Man, where was he for the last 50 years?
Yeah, Roger's had a really interesting career for Roger. Yeah.
Yeah, he has. I think he surfaced this time. They're going to know who he is. That's good.
Yeah, that's for sure. So you're born in Dora, Missouri, moved 200 miles to Memphis, age 9.
Moved from Dora 19 miles away to a little town called West Plains, which is still there. It's probably bigger now. We've been up there. But I lived there for a little, right around a year, and then my dad went to work for the railroad. So he left teaching in the farm. Well, he left teaching to go to the farm, left the farm to be a policeman because of his military experience. And I remember the chief of police, he came home and said, his name was Venus Owens. So I remember his name. And he said, he wants me to go down and fill out an application. They hired my dad on the spot. Hmm. And he came home and he said, well, we're moving to Memphis. I said, what? I mean, that's like taking a kid from nowhere, putting him in Disneyland. It's crazy. So I remember being asleep in the back seat. My dad jarred me a little bit and said, son, you might want to get up and see this. We were getting ready to cross the Mississippi River. I went, whoa. I'd never seen a river a mile wide. I hadn't even seen very many lakes a mile wide. Pretty awesome.
So did you bring some of the musical, influence of Missouri with you?
I don't know. I really don't. Because when I was a young kid, 8, 9, 10, maybe in my early teens, before we moved to Memphis, that was in my teen years, I was listening to Memphis music. We moved in when I was 10. So I had to be 8 or 9 years old. The first time I really heard a band play live. And that was very country bluegrass kind of music. And I've always said, you know, Missouri had the same music Kentucky did, except Kentucky was smart enough to call it something and merchandise it, brand it as bluegrass.
Yeah.
It still had the same music. Well, I did get to play with a guy like Tom Brumley, who dated one of my cousins for a while. I heard him and his band play. And his dad wrote hymn books that were, you know, real thick hymn books. Great songs.
Tom from Buck Owens' band.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. A Small World. So you get to Memphis and you start playing guitar and you're in this high school band, that which evolves into the Marquees. Yeah. Tell me about...
Well, yeah. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So tell
I was going to tell you that Charlie Freeman also played guitar. Mm. And he was taking guitar lessons. Of course, my family couldn't afford them, so I didn't get any guitar lessons in those days. Mm. So when his mother would pick him up once a week to take him to his guitar lesson, I would almost run home and get my guitar and be sitting on his front porch steps whenever he showed up from his lesson. And he would show me what he learned that day, and I would play and help him rehearse whatever work on whatever he learned that day, you know. And that's what I did for a long time.
Yeah, secondhand lesson.
That's how we got started, just the two of us. And a friend later in life, when we were, we were juniors, I guess, at that time, still playing, he thought we were good enough to play for a buddy of his who was a disc jockey. And we went down and auditioned for him, and he says, you guys are great. Is this all you got? And we went, look, he says, yeah, I guess so. He said, you know, if you had a bass player or a drummer, I'd put you on one of my sock hops. And we looked at each other and go, wow. I mean, that was big time to be asked by a disc jockey to do one of the sock hops. Mm. So we went all through school trying to look for a bass player or a drummer. Couldn't find one. We finally found a drummer in the 9th grade who'd been taking lessons for about 3 months. The difference in that was, I mean, he wasn't all that good of a drummer. He turned out to be a great drummer. But his dad had a country band that he sang in, and they used to rehearse all the time in their den. So he said, can you guys come over Saturday and rehearse? I said, yeah, you know, we'll be over there. So we did for 2 or 3 months and came up with, it was still not the Marquees yet, but it was that band. And in our junior year and senior years, we were playing prompts because we played all of the dance music of the day. And we prided ourselves in that. You know, we played James Brown and Ray Charles and those things and some Chuck Berry. And I used to do a bunch of Jimmy Reed things because that was pretty simple stuff. And Chuck Berry and so forth. That's what we did. Little Richard.
So tell me, when did you first hear about Stax? I guess it was Satellite back then. Was it, was that in the air?
Well, Satellite had already had some hits, and we didn't play on any. We were just, Jim Stewart thought we would never make it because we were just snot-nosed kids. But we did play, and we played the music of the day. But Estelle Axe and his sister kept pushing because Charlie Axe and Packy Axe was a tenor player. And she kept pushing for her son, of course. You can't blame her for that. And so she lent Jim Stewart, we had a studio out in, or they had a studio out in Brunswick, Tennessee, which is about 30 minutes outside of Memphis. And this property, the Capitol Theater, became available, and Chips Mumman heard about that. And Chips was the engineer at the time. And he goes to Jim and says, Jim, there's a great opportunity here to build a place out of this old theater. And he said, all we got to do is take the seats out of it and build a studio. And in those days, building a studio was really nothing. You get a board and a console or whatever, and you just take this, put up some curtains and some baffling equipment, and that's all you got to do, deadening stuff, and that's all you got to do. And a lot of guys who can't afford good material, they'll use the backside of egg cartons or whatever they can use to absorb sound. And they kept a Satellite, and they had, I think Cause I Love You was not on Satellite with Rufus and Carla. It was distributed by another label. Maybe it was on Stax. I can't remember. It might have been on Satellite. But anyway, and some local disc jockeys were on Satellite and some other people. And I know Jim was favorable to a group called the Belltones who played over in West Memphis. And their drummer, and I still can't to this day remember his name without looking it up. I said, in your show, he used to throw away his sticks and play with his hands. I said, that thing you do in the middle of the show where you throw away your sticks and play with your hands? He said, yeah. I said, can you just do that lick that you do with your hands with sticks? He said, absolutely. And that's the intro to Last Night. It was that simple in those days. You just make a simple decision. If it's the right decision, you get praised for it. If it's the wrong decision, you get shot in those days or never get asked again to do anything. Huh. I don't know. So you kept making the right decisions. And I've been asked for years. They said, why do you think that Last Night was such a big hit? And I just couldn't come up with a reason. I said, well, it was good. Other than that, I don't know. But I look back when I was thinking back when the first time my mother heard it. I got the record, and I said, Mom, you got to hear our new record, the band's new record, really. So she goes to the front, puts it on, and she starts doing da-da-da-da, starts doing the twist. And I said, that must have been it. It was the first twist instrumental. Well, the twist was already out there. Chubby Checker had it. Hank Ballard and the Midnighters had the original. Then Pat Boone cut it, that kind of craziness. But there's no instrumentals. And we did one like da-da, and it just fit perfectly with that beat, and all the kids started dancing to it.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great record. You mentioned Estelle. I know that you worked in Estelle turned the popcorn area of the movie theater into like a little record shop, and you started in there before you kind of eased your way into the studio. Tell me about her.
Yeah, and
she's not always like...
The thing about them is if you look at Stax, S-T-A-X, Jim Stewart, it's the first two letters of his last name, and A-X, Estelle Axe is the last two letters of her last name. So S-T-A-X, Stax. Stuart Axton.
You don't always hear about her side of the story or her input into what... So tell me, what were her talents?
I think her talent was that she loved R&B music, and she was an authority on it because that's what she sold in a record shop. And we happened to be in one of those neighborhoods, and she said if we ever build a studio, it's got to be in an ethnic, what they call an ethnic in those days, neighborhood. And we were in South Memphis, so there we were. So she could sell her wares and do her thing. I don't know how many records, if she sold any in Brunswick, Tennessee. She had a record shop out there too, but that place was remote. I mean, it was out in the middle of nowhere, out in the middle of the country somewhere, countryside. But we moved to Stax, and there it was.
So eventually, you quit the Marquees, and they basically hand you the keys to the studio, make you a producer. I think were you 19 or 20?
Well, I was 20 years old. So I had called Mrs. Axton, and I said, "Can I have my job back in the record shop?" She said, "Yeah," and I said, "Well, I'll be up there as soon as I can." And I left right in the middle of we had booked after the end of the tour. We had booked 3 weeks for our Booker Gage did, booked us 3 weeks at the Show Bar in Bossier City. And about halfway through, we're taking a break, and Packy's in the stall next to me at the bathroom. And I said, Packy, you've been wanting to be leader of this band for a long time. It's yours. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm catching the bus first thing tomorrow morning and headed back to Memphis. He said, you can't do that. I said, yeah, I've already done it. I got my bus ticket, and I'm going. I'm leaving. And I've got flack for that from people sending me emails saying, man, you left your band right in the middle. No, I didn't leave them. It's, I mean, I did. I left them, but we had another guitar player. Packy was there, so it didn't hurt anybody. Yeah. Nobody knew I was going anywhere. And I don't know. And one day, I don't know how long it took, but one day Estelle went to her brother Jim and said, Jim, you got to start paying Stevie. He spends more time in the studio than he does in the record shop. So they worked something out, and I started getting my salary from him. And I was just doing anything I could, sweeping floors and cleaning out the piano, whatever I could do, logging tapes, marking tapes, editing, you know, did all that. So I didn't edit till years later when Tommy Dowd taught me how, but that's what I did.
I'm looking at photos of you from back in that time, and this is a serious question. You are so skinny, and I'm wondering, did you not have did you have time to eat food? What was going on?
Oh, yeah, but Eddie Floyd says, you know, if Steve is facing you, you can't spy at him. If you turn, I mean, he said, you can't see him. If you turn sideways, you can't find you. So I don't know. I had one of those farmer, you know, physiques, I guess, and where I didn't put on pounds by eating food. Yeah. And they said, where are you putting all that? You know, that same old thing. You have a hollow leg or something? And one of my real good friends who doesn't live in L.A. anymore, but he was my dear friend, an engineer, he could out-eat me and still not gain any weight. If I went overboard after I got into my 30s, I would start gaining weight. So I quit. But you have to understand, my dad, I remember my mom telling me, you know, your dad, when he was 30 years old, he had a 28-inch waist. I said, get out of here. And that was from working on a farm. So whatever he ate, he worked off.
Yeah. So 1962, the original membership of the MGs gets together just to play a session. And it's a pretty what an interesting magical combo, especially because one of the things, you know, Al Jackson's maybe 10 years older than Booker T, who's and you're in between, and Louis Sternberg. Was it apparent to you right away that, hey, this four guys is pretty magical?
No, absolutely not. But we were good at what we did. We knew we could play on sessions. So Louis, the bass player, Louis Steinberg, had already played on Last Night. He was also there as a session bass player and played on Green Onions as well. And that Green Onions would have never happened had the artist that was there to record showed up. And as far as we knew, he didn't. And Estelle later said, oh, yeah, he showed up at the record shop. But it was a Sunday. And, you know, we never cut demos, so we never did get to cut demos. And as far as we knew, he didn't show up because he never came back to the studio. But he showed up at the record shop without a voice because he'd been singing all night on the Saturday night before. So he woke up that morning, couldn't sing, couldn't talk, couldn't do anything. So they said he made it down to the record shop, but he didn't come back to the studio because he didn't want the guys to see him or hear him because he knew he didn't have a voice. And he was pretty famous in those days, and that's why Jim wanted to cut him.
Who was that?
Billy Lee Riley.
Oh, yeah.
What a great name. But he was a spokesman for Dr. Tischner's, I think, and he used to do radio commercials. And he would say, this is Dr. Tischner, so I forget if somebody's commercial. But anyway, that's what it is. So he never just say Billy Lee Riley. So other people knew who it was, but they never promoted his real name. And he was singing and pretty famous in town for doing that. Yeah. But he was also a singer. And I never did see one of his shows. I'm assuming that he did more country-western type material, but I don't know. I have no idea. And he loved R&B, so maybe he did R&B songs too.
Yeah, I mean, I only know his Sun record, so I wish I could have known what he would have ended up doing at Stax. So
yeah, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Well, I'm glad he didn't, right? Because or else we wouldn't have Green Onions. So tell me about Al
exactly.
Jackson. I mentioned he's a little bit older than you guys. Was he somebody who you knew as a kid, who you'd seen a million times playing at gigs?
Well, not a million times, but quite a few. And he kept his gig, but we kept saying, Al, you got to come over and talk to Jim Stewart. I know he'd hire you on the spot. Nah, I don't need that. Now, you got the thing about Al Jackson, people don't know this. He'd been playing since he's 5 years old. His dad had a big orchestra swing band back in the 30s, I guess, 30s and 40s. And so Al started playing for him when he was like five as a showstopper, you know. They'd bring this little kid up, and he'd set him on the drums, and he'd play and just knock people out. So he was well-seasoned when we got him.
Gotcha. What a special, special drummer he is. I mean, just one of the...
He played on so many hits.
Yeah.
He just played on hit after hit after hit. And all that Al Green stuff and all that. Willie Mitchell with being a producer. He played in Willie Mitchell's band, and they were... The place, I guess, that Duck and I really locked on to him a lot was the Club Manhattan. You know, that's where he was playing every night. And so we finally got him to come down. And so Jim, I think, made a deal with him. He said, you can still work for Willie, but we'll pay you to work here if you just do sessions during the week. He says, okay. So Willie, knowing this, he used to cut Al Green at, you know, when they'd get off stage at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So Al would come home totally wasted and exhausted. And I'd call his wife. I said, you know, we got a session at 11, and it would already be 10 or 10:30 or something. I hadn't seen Al. And so she said, Steve, you're going to have to come over and wake him up. I try, and he comes up swinging. He wants to knock me out. I used to go over and poke him with a broom. He'd come up swinging. I said, Al, we got a session. I don't care about your damn session. I said, you're getting paid to do the session. Oh, okay. He'd get up, and we were out and lumber over there and play his butt off, of course.
That's great.
He was something else. He never got Duck and I lost, I guarantee you that. We always knew where one was. No matter what song we were playing, Al always knew where to plant his foot to let us know where one was.
Yeah. He's driving the bus.
He was driving the bus, you bet it. Yeah. And the thing is, when you know, we got asked to play a lot of gigs. We couldn't because we were session musicians. So we worked only weekends from time to time. And when we did, Al was the guy that would pay attention to the dancers. So if we came in on that Monday after that weekend, that next session would be the beat that Al watched those kids dancing to. And even though, you know, some of the beats were the same, but the dances were different. Each city had its own dance in those days, back in the late 50s and whatever. They had their own dance and early 60s. So that's why you had so many dances when Hullabaloo and all those places were on. American Bandstand, all those kids were dancing to a different drummer every time. And Al knew where that accent was. He just knew where to put it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So, like, for the next decade or so, you are involved in, I would say, almost every record, you know, recorded or even issued by Stax. Like, you're playing, you're writing, you're producing. So tell me, like, it's incredible. So tell me about your busiest year. Out of 365 days, how many?
God, I have no idea. The busiest year.
I mean, how
many
days?
We're all busy.
Are you recording 40 weeks a year, 30 weeks a year?
I have no idea. I didn't even keep track of it. I don't know. But I have been asked several times, how did you know this was a hit? How did you know that was a hit? We didn't. We just, there was another song. So if we did 3 songs in a session, 2 songs, or 4 songs, or 5, they all got the same energy, same treatment. And then we would decide later, the record company would, you know, it's A&R people would decide what was going to be on the radio, what would be released out of that session. And so a lot of artists, we only had one day session, and you'd cut an A side, a B side, and then, you know, basically an A one you're shooting for the A side, and then maybe 2 B sides or whatever. You don't think of it, no. And the musicians didn't think of it that way.
Gotcha.
Maybe the writers did. You know,
I assume that it didn't work like Hollywood or Nashville with 3-hour union sessions. Was it just open ended time wise? Just keep going until you got something?
Yeah, it was. We went until we got it, and sometimes we'd work all day long. But Jim, I don't know, misunderstood the union rules, and it wasn't about 3 hours to him. It was about 3 songs to him. So when we got 3 songs, he'd clear a session. Well, in Memphis, Tennessee, I guess that was good. And the other thing is, the guys like Bob Taylor was a big executive for the musicians union, and other guys would show up on the sessions and all that sort of stuff. Some of them got to play on some of the sessions, and others didn't. I know Bob Taylor was a good trumpet player, and I can't remember if he played on anything or not. Because we had great trumpet players. We had Wayne Jackson. We couldn't get him. We had Bolaz Miller, and different trumpet players when Wayne couldn't make it for whatever. And so Wayne was a great trumpet player.
Oh, great horns on all the stack stuff. Were you guys getting paid for the day, for the song, for the session?
No, we got paid for the songs. And whether it was scale or not, even close, we don't know. But I do know, I remember us getting paid around $15 per track.
Oh,
and that
wow.
was a lot of money in those days.
Oh. Yeah.
So if we had a 3-track session, multiply that times 3, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I guess
what,
so.
What is that, $45? Not bad for a little day's working, just taking around with a little music. Because music, you're not supposed to make money at music in those days.
Right, and here we are 60
we
years
did.
60 years later, we're still selling those same songs over and over again. It's kind
yeah,
of...
and the good news is that I've had some of the horn players and other musicians call me and said, Steve, we're so glad you kept records on all that stuff.
Hmm.
So I'd go in and, you know, turn in the sessions, and I'd keep that yellow sheet, and I kept it around. And here's the difference. If a movie or something or a TV show uses the old original session, the musicians get paid by today's scale, not by the scale of the 60s. And that's, you know, they'll get a check for $300 maybe for playing on a song rather than a check for $15.
Yeah.
So they were glad. They said, whoa, wow, that's pretty cool. Thank you for keeping records, for turning that in.
Mm. Yeah, so
and,
we're talking
you know,
about.
That's one of my jobs.
During those busy times, you know, Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett and Sam and Dave and Eddie Floyd and Rufus and Carla and Johnny Taylor and the Staple Singers and Albert King and Don Covey, was it fun? I mean, were you having the time of your life?
Absolutely. And I will tell you this about Otis Redding. You mentioned his name. When he was coming back to town, the musicians would just go up, 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 up. They couldn't wait for him to get back in.
Hmm.
And the thing is that the last group of sessions we did on Otis, he didn't have anything booked. It was not on tour. He was always on tour in demand, either in Europe or wherever. So we only got him usually one day at a time. And I remember it might have been the Otis Blue album, where we cut all day long, and then everybody went home, did their gig, ate, and, you know, took a shower. And if they had a night gig, do the gig, and then we all showed up back at the studio and finished the album.
Mm.
And I remember it was daytime the next day, and his band and bus pulled up in the back of the studio. And after a while, they started screaming. So the others, come on, it's time to go, man. And they're screaming. That was a session where we did the last. He says, wait a minute, guys, I've got one more idea. Can't turn your lips. You believe that? We had already had a hit on the time of sight. Dun, 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 dun. It's just slightly different. It's the same notes, but slightly played slightly different.
Yeah.
Da, 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 instead of da, 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 da. So I think Duck and I screwed up on one of the tracks of a movie, the Jules Dassin film. We went over to Paris. We played You Can't Turn You Loose to the Time Is Tight. We had to recut it later.
So during this time, did you have like a life mentor? Because, you know, how did you cope with all this stuff? Did you go crazy? Did you just keep your act together?
I guess. I don't know. It wasn't time to do any of that stuff. And the thing about Otis is I always looked up at Otis as my older brother.
Hmm.
We were very close, but he was just older than me. He was wiser than me. He was older than me. I had no idea we were the same age until I read about his obituary after he passed away and found out we were the same age. I said, Get out of here. So his birthday was in September. Mine was in October. I knew that, but I thought, man, you know, he's got to be 2 or 3 years older than me at least. He wasn't. Same age.
That's amazing.
But we had a lot in common because he was just a good old Georgia country boy, and I was a Missouri country boy.
You mentioned that, like, you wouldn't know if a song was a hit or not. You guys were working so hard. I assume you were just kind of in your own world a little bit and didn't know the impact.
Well, you know, the thing is, I think I mentioned this earlier, that probably the writers of the songs knew what they wanted. You know, if they wrote 3 songs, they knew which one they thought was the better one.
Hmm.
But I don't, when they presented to us, we just took them as equal.
Hmm.
So we didn't know. But I do know that Al will pick out a song. How about Soul Man? I remember I was mixing tapes, and Isaac Hayes came back to the control room. He said, Cropper, I know you don't want to be bothered. However, he said, I think David Porter, and I have written a hit for tomorrow's session, but I can't come up with an intro. And he knew I had a reputation of being an intro guy. So I went down, and I said, okay, I plug up my guitar, and I said, play something. He said, no, you play something. I said, no, you play something. I'll just play to it. And he just plays a set of changes, and that was the intro. And I just use what they call, I think the legal name is, or the actual name is called hammer tones, and I call them hammer licks. Booty, that's a hammer lick. Doo-dee-doo-doo. And it's the first string and the third string on guitar.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
And so just that was just 5 minutes coming up with that or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Very simple. Very quick. One time through. He just played those changes, and I went for it, and that was it. And, of course, he had the modulation. That's a quick, easy modulation, except the song is over after that. Most modulations happen in the middle of the song. Soul Man, there's three verses, then the instrumental modulation. There's a bridge. Grab the rope, I'll pull you in, give you hope and be your only boyfriend. And then you do the intro again, and that's where it modulates, and it's out.
Were you guys listening to, like, Top 40 Radio or Motown or Muscle Shoals? Were you keeping track of that stuff? Or
well,
when
you say Top 40, we were, but that's pop. And so we were listening to the top of the charts on R&B stations. We listened to LOK or DIA all the time. Now, every now and then, I would listen to some pop stuff, but I got most of mine listening to gospel stations and WDA and Reuben Watson, who I still say broke up. Green Onions, and it didn't even have a title yet. But I took the demo down. I knew we had something that was pretty catchy, pretty danceable. And I got Scotty Moore. I called Scotty, and I said, we cut something yesterday. Can you cut me a dub on it? And he said, yeah, that's what we call them in those days, just a dub or whatever. So he said, hey, that's pretty catchy. I said, that's what I thought. And so I took it down to Reuben Morrison at WLOK, who had the drive time slot. At WLOK, and I took it down to him. I said, I think we cut something Sunday. I had Scotty cut me a little demo yesterday. I want you to hear it and tell me what you think. And he listens to the intro and about two or three bars and stops it, backs it up. I said, you don't like it? He said, no, I love it. I just want to make sure I heard what I heard. What I didn't know, he hit the switch, put it out on the air, and while it's playing, the phones lit up. And all I could hear was his end. And he'd say, I don't know, but we're going to find out. I don't know, but we're going to find out. He'd pick up the phone. I don't know, but we're going to find out. So I had to leave and go back to the record shop to catch by 9 o'clock work time. So I show up and Mrs. Axis says, something's going on, and I bet you're responsible. I said, you're not talking about this. She said, yeah. People, but the phone is ringing off the wall, want to know where they can buy what they heard on the radio this morning. I said, get out of here. I didn't know. So she calls Jim at work and says, when you take your lunch break, you better get back to the studio. And because there's something going on you need to know about. So we tell Jim, or he finds out what's going on. He said, call in the guys. We've got to have an emergency meeting. And he called the guys and said, guys, we want to put this out. But we need a name for the group, and we need a name for the record. And I can tell you that Louis Steinberg said, well, let's name it Onions. And we go, okay, why Onions? He said, because that's the stankiest music I ever heard. I got to thinking, and I'm just one of those guys. It's just natural. I said, well, you know, Onions are great, but it has a little negativity to it. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, when some people cut into onions, it makes them cry. And other people eat onions, and it gives them indigestion. How about green onions? Oh, I never thought about that. I said, okay, green onions. They're on everybody's dinner plate. Nobody gets sick. Doesn't make people cry when they pick them or clean them or whatever. So it became Green Onions.
Yeah, maybe.
The MGs, I can tell you and everybody that the MGs was definitely for the MG Triumph car. And we got a letter after we put that out saying they didn't want to be connected with music in any way. And somebody correct, I forget what they said. But anyway, that was the gist of it. They didn't want to be connected with anything to do with music. So Jim called everybody in and says, guys, we've got to re-release the record and change the name of the group. We said, we're not changing the name of the group. And that's when we come up with Memphis Group.
Mm.
And still had the same initials, Booker T and E, Memphis Groups. It was always the Memphis Groups. And I've said, if we went out now, if Booker and I went out on tour, it'd be Booker T and the MG.
MG?
I can laugh about that now. MG, because the other three are gone.
Yeah.
Duck, Al, and Louie are all gone. And yeah. It's sad.
That is
sad. And when I lost Duck, I definitely lost my best friend.
Mm. Yeah, I think I spoke to him, a couple years before he died, and he said the same about you. We mentioned Estelle earlier, and Jim is also such an interesting guy. He signed the worst contract in the history of the music business, right? He didn't know anything about soul music, or really, he didn't start out knowing anything about recording music, but he must have fostered an amazing atmosphere, or was it just luck?
No, I don't think it was luck. I mean, it was luck that he had the studio. But, you know, Jim Stewart was a violin player, a fiddle player, and it was a very good one, very talented. Had been one a long time. And so he kind of came by that naturally. So he knew songs and music. I mean, he knew when he heard a good song. And I tell a story about Jim now. Doug said, I love working at Saks. I just wish Jim Stewart would look at us that way with his hand on his chin, looking out the glass. He said, that would tear anybody's mood down. I said, you know, I got to think about that. Why did he do it? Well, the thing about Jim had a thing. If you fought for what you wanted, he knew you had something going. And if you didn't fight for it, say, like, bye-bye, see you later. So that was his game, I think. Must have worked.
Interesting. As a songwriter, you know, like Al Jackson really, I mean, you guys co-wrote all the instrumentals, but real songwriting, you know, you were the most prolific of the MGs by a mile. Do you think you're just born with this extra gene in your body, or does it?
I guess. I don't know. I have no idea, but I know when I got hung up on a word, I would have called my mom and asked her to spell it. She could always spell it. She was a school teacher. She could spell it. So I showed Jim. I take him the song that I said, Carla wants to cut this. She really likes it. And the song is called No Time to Lose. And I put two O's, No Time to Lose. Oh, he said, I think you need to change the spelling to No Time to Lose instead of loose. I never thought about that.
That's great.
Okay, I changed it. And I remember when I was working at a grocery store one time, they put me in I could make the signs up, and I didn't know how to spell mayonnaise, and I couldn't get my mom on the phone. So I spelled it the way I thought it should be spelled, and I got fired right on the spot. And the manager saw that. He said, you're fired.
That's the best. That's great.
I don't even remember how I spelled it, but it wouldn't spell right. Mayonnaise. It wasn't spelled properly.
You're fired.
Yep.
Famously, you and Eddie Floyd would go get a room at the Lorraine Motel, which is a museum now, and you just write songs because there'd be a session booked for the next day. That's a lot of pressure. Like, you better have some songs because there's somebody coming in to record.
Right. Well, we knew that we could write songs, so it wasn't like a last-minute kind of a thing, like a rush test or anything. We knew what we were doing. And Eddie always, when he came in, he always had an idea for a hit. Wasn't always the right idea, but it turned out to be the right idea. So I remember on Knock on Wood, he said, Cop, I got a great idea to write a song. I said, what? He said, I want to write a song about superstitions. I said, okay. So I went in and we went through the gamut of everything you can think of that's superstitious. And it wasn't anything to do with Stevie's record, Stevie Wonder, but we went through the gamut of, you know, black cats and umbrellas and inside a room and breaking champagne glasses and throwing salt over your shoulder, walking under the ladders, all that. Nothing worked. And at the end of all that, after about an hour and a half, I said, Eddie, what do people do for good luck? He says, hey, on wood. And I said, there's our song. They knock on wood for good luck. And that's where that song came from. And I said, this woman is so special, I better knock on wood so I don't lose her. Better wish good luck on this one.
You don't have to answer this one if you don't want to. When you guys are writing songs or cutting songs, would you have a few drinks?
No, never. No drugs, no alcohol with any of those hits, ever. That's with Wilson, Don Covey, Eddie Floyd, all those guys. No.
That's great.
We didn't do it in those days.
And tell me about writing with Otis Redding. I mean, you mentioned that he was just like a hurricane that people could not wait to come into their contact.
The thing about writing songs with Otis, he would have 13, 14, 15 ideas unfinished, and I helped him finish them.
Gotcha.
That's why my name's there. The difference is that if you look and you see a record with my name on it, listen to the lyrics. It's always about him somewhere. So he was just bigger than life. He was very easy to write about.
Interesting.
And it worked.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he got it. He might have gotten it because he knew he was called the Big O. And I was going home one night after a session, and I heard one of the dish sockets says, "Here's a brand new one from the Mr. Pitiful himself." And I said, "Mr. Pitiful." So I start writing it in the shower the next morning. I didn't finish it. I pick Otis up at the hotel. I said, "Otis, got a great idea for a song. What's that?" "Mr. Pitiful." And I sang him part of it. We finished it in the car. That's the first thing we taught the band. It's real do, 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 do. He was singing. I started humming the bass line. So I'm teaching that to Duck, and he's coming up with the horns on the other parts. And the other one that I've always been in love with is the Fa 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 sad song. Mm. And he was giving me, we had written another song. I wish I could remember what the other song was. I can't. But he was giving me the sound, what he wanted, horns. He'd go, "Fa Fa 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 Fa." I said, "There's our song right there." And that's what, when a tenor player puts on a new reed, that's what he does. He goes, to make sure the reed's working properly.
Okay.
And that's where they came from. And then the lyrics, "I've been singing these sad, sad songs. Y'all, sad songs is all I know." And that's true. I keep singing these sad, sad songs, y'all. Mr. Pitiful. They call me Mr. Pitiful. Almost everywhere I go, they call me Mr. Pitiful. This everybody know, but yeah, nobody seems to understand what makes a man feel so blue. He made it work because I lost someone just like you. Well, it should be I lost someone just like you did. I lost someone too. He should have sang that, but he didn't.
It must be so satisfying to like see these go from your brain onto tape in 24 hours or less, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was a neat thing in those days.
Yeah.
Because you could write a song the night before, go in the next day and get a good cut on it and listen to it all night long.
Yeah, be in the store 2 weeks later,
And maybe that's when the alcohol came out. I don't know. Every now and then we drink a little alcohol and listen to our playbacks, you know. That has fun.
Yeah. I want to mention a few songs here, and I want you to just comment on them. Like, just give me a sentence or two or some memory, just real short on these songs. And these are all songs that you wrote or co-wrote. What'll I Do for Satisfaction by Johnny Day, 1967.
Well, my memory of that one is very simple. Janet Jackson covered it. And that was going to be the name of her next tour. What'll I Do? What'll I Do for Satisfaction? Has nothing to do with the record Satisfaction, the Stones song. And Keith knew that too. I still have a letter from Keith in my file thing. It may go in the book. I don't know. I'll go dig through it and find it. But anyway, he said, "Cropper, I had nothing to do with this." That was his manager did. So here's the funny thing. And Terry Jam and who produced that? Terry and his co-partner.
Jimmy Lewis.
Anyway, he apologized. Yeah, Jimmy. He apologized to me one night. He said, "Man, I'm sorry." So when the song was done, when our song was through singing, she went, "I can't get no satisfaction." Don't do that, Janet. She did. And it only cost us, the royalties on about $3.5 million. So I watched her get an award for $10 million and went on to sell another six. So it's nice to have a song on a Janet record, on any Jackson record, I guess.
Gotcha. So she sang that one line and it became a medley and not just your song. Yeah.
Right.
That's amazing.
And our song was, "What'll I Do for Satisfaction? Honey, who'll take care of me now?" Has nothing to do with "I can't get no." And Otis said, "I can't get me no satisfaction." He had his own way of communicating with people.
Tell me about Barbecue by Wendy Renee.
What do you want to know about it?
Do you remember writing it? You remember cutting it?
Well, I do. And I remember Wendy well. And we did a lot of stuff together. But her brother, Johnny, was a great guitar player, and he is actually on Who's Making Love too. We had three guitar players on the session that day. So,
yeah, great song. You remember the Cobras?
Very rare.
The Cobras, Restless.
Sort of. Yeah, with Duck. You know why it was named the Cobras? Because he had a cobra.
Who?
So there was a lot of instrumental hits named after cars: the Triumphs, the MGs. The Cobras.
Oh, I thought you meant the animal. I thought you had a snake. I was like, what?
No. It was a car called a Cobra. Duck had one, so we named it the Covers.
You co-write Goodnight Baby with David Porter, 1965.
Goodnight Baby. Well, my favorite, yeah, that is true, and I don't dwell on that one too much. The one I like is Patch My Heart. Big record.
What about Raise Your Hand, co-write with Eddie Floyd?
Well, you know, Eddie and I knew that was a hit, and we proved it live because the audience goes nuts when he does Raise Your Hand.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But I guess we put it out too soon. It was released too soon, so it didn't get the airplay. They were still working off of Knock on Wood. So I it was my idea. I said, Eddie, we need to write something for the audience, a participation song. Just raise your hand, and they'll raise their hand and do all that.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Great idea.
And it worked. It was a great idea, and it works. You know, he sang with us 15-plus years. I forget how long, but I know he sang with us over 15 years with the Blues Brothers. And we had to sort of reform that band. It was a lot of the original members with Matt Guitar Murphy, myself, Donald McDonough, the horns and all that. Different drummer and different keyboard player, but, you know, still the same band, basically. And Eddie sang with us as a lead singer for well over 15 years and did the movie. And so Wilson Pickett comes to me and he says, Cropper, I got to ask you, how come Eddie Ford's singing my hit? I said, well, number one, he wrote it. Number two, he's the lead singer with the band. And it's our movie. Bless his heart. I don't blame him for saying so. I would have been really upset, but he never said a word. And they had all that script written. Danny had written Ed's Love Exchange. And I remember 8 years before we actually went to filming that movie, Danny came around to all the musicians and said, we're doing a Blues Brothers 2 movie. Great. 8 years later, we did.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, made good on his word. That, yeah, I mean, that must have been a fun experience with those guys. Let me ask you about the song. Somebody, you and Eddie would write a song, or Isaac and David would write a song. Somebody would write a song and bring it in. And I have this imagination that the whole process was very organic, that someone would just play it on a piano or a guitar, and then you'd all just pick up your parts without much to do. Is that how easy it was?
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, it was always up to Booker or Isaac or to present their songs, and mine, of course, came out of the guitar, and that's the way we did it.
Yeah.
Everybody, you're right. Everybody just sort of picked up on it and made their instrument go with that song.
That is mind-blowing.
So I can't tell you which ones, but some of the horn parts, some of the horn lines would come as unison lines. And then the horns themselves, if they felt it needed to be voiced, they would. And they'd do the harmony to it. You take this note, I'll take that one. We used to do that. So we called it head arranging. And they just hum them something. So some of them they came up with, some of them I came up with, some of them Otis came up with. A lot of Otis came up with, and he came up with that, da, 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 you know, the real fast stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, those guys were good enough to play that stuff. Otherwise, they would have lost it. Some of those, I listened to it today, and I'm still amazed at some of those horn lines. How did they work that out and make that work? It's great.
That is one of the most signature part of the Stack sound, is that those horns. You know, it's like nothing else.
Well, I do say that with all due respect to the singers that sang on all those songs. If you take the singers off, you still got the song.
Yeah.
If you take singers off today's music, I'm sorry about this. If you take the singer off today's music, you still got the music, and that's what you got. You don't have the song anymore. You got the music.
I 100%
agree. You cut that out if you want to.
No, I agree with you 100%. Let's talk about Race for a minute, because Booker T and the MGs, a famously integrated band, and, you know, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King gets shot at the motel, which is like 3 miles away from
Glory Motel, right.
How did that change the world of Stax Records?
Well, the way I remember it is we were in San Francisco getting ready to play Fillmore West. And we were already there. We were supposed to be on a show with the Supremes, and they never got on a plane. So Memphis was a little bit different when we got home, a little bit. But I can tell you, as far as an integrated group, there was no color at Stax, period. We just looked at each other as another human being that's there for the same reason, same purpose, to get a hit record. That was all we were there for. We had fun playing music together, but we were there strictly to get a hit record. When we played on a live gig, we were there to entertain people. And we'd do it by playing songs that they knew us for. In the early days, we had a singer and we had a saxophone player because we were doing other music by other people. There was no way to play Green Onions for 2 or 3 hours. So you did other songs. Everybody goes through that. They get a hit and they get all asked to do all these venues and all that stuff, and that's all well and good. And if they've been out there on the road for a long time, they usually have been trying to make it, finally make it, then they've got a repertoire of songs that can play. But if they're one time only, first time out and got a hit, what are they going to do on stage? That one song and then it's over with, that's it. So you better look like you're doing something. That's what Al Jackson always said. And so I mentioned this the other day. I said, Al Jackson always told us, it's not what you're doing, it's what you look like you're doing. Now, this was before the days of big screen TVs and big PA systems where if you got 400,000 people, the people in the last row could still hear and see what's going on stage. In those days, you couldn't. That PA wouldn't reach more than about 2 rows, and that was about it. If you weren't in the first 2 rows, you didn't hear the concert. You saw it, but you didn't hear it. So Al used to say, you better look like you're doing something because that's what counts. And he's right about that. Move around a little bit. Well, they don't have to move around so much today. They could just sit, stand there and play their notes, you know, and that's pretty cool.
But there must have been some people who did not like the idea of an integrated band. Did that reach you, that message?
Well, no, that message never got to me. There were a couple places that I recall that we would finish a concert and head downtown to the local hotel and go to check in, and somebody would say, well, hey, you guys can't check in here. You're a mixed group, you know. So we just, okay, jump back in the car. You don't want our business? Fine, we'll see you later. Didn't even faze us. We just go to the edge of town and pick up a motel. They were glad to see us. Book us a room and go to get a couple hours sleep and head out on the road the next day.
Yeah. Let me ask you some guitar geek questions. I believe on Green Onions you're playing a Fender Esquire. Was that a special guitar, and do you still have it?
I don't have it. It was not special. I don't have it. It was a old used guitar that I sanded down and wanted painted candy apple red. And I sanded down to the wood, and I went down to Western Auto in those days and got a can of candy apple spray paint, and I sprayed it. It turned purple instead of red. And somebody said, keep it, man, that's a good looking color, keep it. I'm going, okay. I didn't prime it, you know, I just put it in the wood and it absorbed it. I guess there was purple color in that paint somehow, but on the outside it was candy apple red. If you sprayed metal, it would turn out candy apple red, but I just sprayed it on that raw wood and it turned purple. And I kept it forever. So I played that on a lot of songs on the Green Onions album. I definitely played on Green Onions and got it out to play on some of Otis' stuff. He liked the sound of it, so I used it on a few songs.
What happened to it?
And then I have no idea what happened to it. The last time I heard about it, it was on somebody's wall. And I said, well, go over and tell them that belongs to me. I want it back. And when the person was told that, they collapsed, fainted, went into convulsions, and I said, leave it on the damn wall. I mean, it's fine. If they think it's theirs, leave it on the wall.
How many guitars have you got?
So there's more than I can play. I wish I could play the one I have. I guess.
One more guitar geek question. The reverb on the solo on Green Onions comes on halfway through the solo. Is that done in the mixing, or are you turning on that switch with your foot?
No, it's done in the mixing, and I want you to listen to it again sometime. It was Jim Stewart's, he was the engineer that day. It was his idea to do what I was doing in the middle. He said, Steve, you know that thing you're doing in the middle of the song? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you put that on the intro, and when it comes to that 8 bars, just play a regular solo. I said, okay, and I want you to listen to it. I hit him so hard. I hit the board, the needle, or whatever. He almost turned me off grabbing the knob. And you can hear him sneaking me back up during that 8-bar solo.
Oh, okay.
That first up, you know, I go, what is it doing? Damn, it is so hot. But it come out, didn't distort. That's the good news. It came out okay.
Yeah.
But I hear it every time I hear that record. I hear him almost turning me off. And then he eases me back in. So to answer your question, the echo was added. And that is the old, one of the bathroom it stacks. And so I think Jim said it was a girl's bathroom, not the boy's bathroom. I thought it was a boy's bathroom. So if you walk into the theater, there's a restroom on the left, one on the right. It was the one on the left. And to tell you about that bathroom, David Porter was in there using one time. And so Isaac said, David, hurry up, man. You know, we got to get this song written. He said, hold on, I'm coming. And Isaac said, there's a hit right there. How about that being a hit? Hold on, I'm coming.
That's a true story?
That is a true story. Not making that up.
Yeah, that's great. So, Green Onions, how long from the minute you guys started sort of playing it till the recording was finished?
The recording was finished the day we recorded it. Before the record came out, it might have taken 2 weeks. Week and a half, 2 weeks.
But to work the whole arrangement up and get the whole thing done, was that a matter of a couple hours?
No. Happened on the spot, spontaneously. Mm. And the flip side, to tell you the story of Green Onions. So the guy, we're waiting on this artist to show up. To us, he never did show. So just to keep, I guess, to keep our chops up or whatever, Booker started playing some blues stuff, and we just fell in and started playing it. Well, Jim Stewart reaches over. He hears music, and he just pushes a record button. So we get through. We're laughing and all that sort of stuff. That was a lot of fun. And Jim gets on the talk back and says, hey, guys, come and listen to this. What? You recorded that? Yeah, I recorded it. So he says, no name or nothing. There was just a blues track, and it turned out to be the flip side, Behave Yourself. But anyway, he said, guys, if we decided to put something like this out, do you have anything you could put on the B-side? In those days, there was an A-side, a B-side to a record. And we just looked dumbfounded. And that went on for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes. And I look at Booker, and I said, Booker, I remember you played me a riff a couple, 3 weeks ago that you thought would be good for a vocal song. You remember that riff? And he said, no, but if you come down to the organ, I'll play a couple of things. You can tell me if that was one of them. And the first one he played was Green Onions. I said, that's it.
Yeah.
Whatever. So we started cutting it, and 4 cuts later, we had it.
Mm.
So I think the cut that Jim made the suggestion on the third take, we hadn't taken it after the third take, he made that suggestion. That thing you're doing in the middle, put that on the front as an intro and then do a solo. And that was the 4th take, as far as I can remember. Mm. What I do remember about that song, it originally came out on Volt 102. And so Jerry Wexler, Atlantic was our big distributor in those days, our national distributor. So Jerry calls and says, get that song off of Volt and get it on Stax. We don't have time to promote a new record, new label. Okay. And that's the only thing we did. So we called Plastic Products and had them change the stamper from the Volt to the Stax. And, you know, Jim had it all going. I mean, Volt, it would have still been a hit probably, and it would have made the Volt label. Well, we used Otis to make the Volt label later. Mm.
Tell me about going to the UK. I think in 1967. That
right.
Tour,
May, April and May of 19.
There's some film of that tour, and the audience are going mad.
Yep, pretty much. We had no idea that our records were taken off over there. And, you know, Atlantic was big over there. We had no idea they were big over there. So things like Walking the Dog was a big hit. Green Onions was a monster hit over there. And Otis's songs were big hits. And, you know, Otis, from These Arms of Mine, had 17 in a row. But he was big over in Europe. And Phil Walden, his manager at the time, knew that. And Joe Gawkin knew it. And that was his original manager. The reason was that Joe Gawkin was the manager of Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers, and Otis was the singer in that band, and that's how These Arms of Mine came about. So he was big in Europe, and he had met Tom Jones and people like that, you know, and he was always working overseas. That's why we didn't get him to record very much, and when he come over here, he already had tours lined up, so we only got him for one day at a time or something. Hmm. Except that last couple of weeks that he recorded, we had him for full time. And you can leave this in the tape if you want to. Otis told me on the way to the studio one day, he said, Steve, I'm going to get me an apartment here in Memphis, and you and I are going to write songs and produce records. I said, Otis, that's a great idea. And he was coming off of Do You Like Soul Music with Arthur Conley. Oh, yeah. And that reminded me because, he was on that tour, Arthur was, on that 67 Volt Stax Volt tour. And so that was one of the few records, not few, I don't know how many he produced, but that was one of the ones that hit that Otis did. So he knew he had it in him. He had the production ideas in him. And he always had hit ideas, but they were unfinished. And that's why I was allowed to finish them with him. There's some that I didn't write with him. He wrote I've Been Loving You Too Long, I think, with Jerry Butler. And, oh, man, he wrote hundreds of songs that he wrote himself. I didn't take anything. It was the ones that were totally unfinished, that he had intros and maybe a first verse, and that was it. Hmm. And I would help him musically and lyrically finish the songs. And like I say, and I still stick to this, I've got to listen myself sometimes to make sure I know what I'm talking about. If there's any song in there that has my name on it, it's usually the words are usually about him. I would say probably all of them are, but I say usually because I really don't know. I hadn't taken time to listen to all of them. I'm just not one of those guys. I listen to radio, but I never did really listen to records a lot. I didn't collect records. Hmm. I mean, I had several that was given to me. I still have some that are unopened.
Ah, wow.
Some DJ samples that are totally unopened. And I have a lot of test pressings, they call them. Hmm. And I remember one, and I'll tell you this story. I remember one time, Tommy Dowd stayed at my house. He leaves to go back to New York, and the mailman delivers something. And I called Tommy, and I said, Tommy, you got some mail here. And he said, it's probably that Rascals record. Open it up and tell me what you think. And it was Groovin'. I called him back and said, Tommy, this thing is a hit. So I took it to the studio the next day, and Booker T and the MGs cut it.
Yeah.
But we couldn't put it out because the Brassels hadn't been out yet. So we waited till our record was a hit. And then we released ours, and it was a hit.
Yeah.
So
that's great story.
Luck or no luck, it's one idea after the other.
Yeah. You know, the story of Stax has been told so many times. Do you think the general story that's out there is accurate to your experience? Is there stuff?
Well, I don't know. And the minute I'm reading a book and it gets into something that didn't happen, I just close it up and put it aside. So I don't read a lot of books. But I can tell you that Sweet Soul Music is about 90% accurate compared to a lot of the other ones.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, it's a great book.
About sex. So I don't know.
Was it emotional when things kind
of... Rob Bowman.
When things fell apart at Stax at the end for you?
No. I'd already moved on. I didn't, you know. I predicted it anyway, and you know, it happened a year after I predicted it, so... And all I predicted was, I said, you know, in 2 or 3 years from now, or I said 3 or 4 years, not 2 or 3, I said 3 or 4 years, they'll padlock this place and put a fence around it. And they did.
Yeah.
You couldn't get in. Holy mackerel. So
the catalog's been bought and sold a million times. Whoever owns it, are they in touch with you? Are they doing a good job?
They were doing an okay job. Universal wound up with it. And when they had the right people, it was going great. And I remember a time when I had two or three movies running every month, either on Showtime, HBO, or one of the others. And when I could tell you who the guy's name that was doing that was Derek Albert, Herb Albert's son, Derek. And he pushed that catalog and got people to do those movies. And then he passed it on to somebody else, and they were doing a good job. And then that went away, and Universal owned it. Nothing happened after that, I don't think. I might have been in some... The only films I was in after that were films that where I was a music director on them or something. None of the Stax stuff was used.
Hmm.
And I remember... I don't watch movies that much either. But we did have... Doc of the Bay was in Top Gun, in the original Top Gun. And I know some publishers didn't even know that. And I tell them that, and they go, what? Doc of the Bay's in there? And I said, yeah. So the thing is, they probably remember the soundtrack. It was not in the soundtrack, but it was in the movie. Gotcha. And I had a friend call me that re-released old soundtracks. He said, I did you a favor today. I said, what's that? He said, I put Doc of the Bay in the new video soundtrack. I said, no kidding. He said, yeah, it's in there.
Yeah, you mentioned you don't watch movies much. What do you do besides play guitar?
Well, I used to play a lot of golf, and I used to go hunting a lot and fishing a lot. But, you know, age gets up with you, and, you know, it's not fun to take a boat out anymore and do all that work. So And I said, for years here, the only thing I miss L.A. about, they say, do you miss L.A.? I said, absolutely not. But I do miss my sport fishing boat. Now, I grew up on rivers and lakes in Missouri and all over, but it just doesn't do it for me anymore. You know, after you get used for years catching 200 or 300 pound fish, you catch one that's 3 or 4 pounds, it doesn't mean that much anymore. It should, but it does.
Right.
So I don't know.
Let's get back to the new record is called Fire It Up, and folks can go to playitsteve.com for information about your whole life and about this new record. The title track has that thing you were talking about, the E and the G string. You call it the hammering. What do you call it?
Hammer licks.
Hammer licks. I mean, that is like signature.
The Soul Man is played on the first string, which is the highest one, and the third string. So the sixth string is the lowest one. That's a low E. Hmm. And you don't play hammer licks on that. No. I do another style that I play on the A string and the D string, but that's about it.
Yeah. Are you going to tour behind this record? Are you looking forward to, like, when things kind of open up a little bit, getting back on the road? And
we'll see what happens with that. If there's a demand for it, yes. And there's no reason for me to say no if the demand is. If I have to be, if they're going to tie me down to vaccinations and that stuff to do it, I guess I'll miss out. I don't know. That's silly. But I'm not one of those guys that's a herd mentality.
What do you mean?
Well, usually when the government says to do something, everybody jumps on it and does it. I don't. I never did. Huh. If they told me to go fishing, I'd tell them where to go.
Gotcha.
My mom and dad, if mom and dad were still alive and they said, son, you need to get your vaccination, I probably would do it. Because I remember somebody told me, recently, they said, you know, if we were talking about polio, we wouldn't have this conversation. I didn't wait till I was 21 years old to get vaccinated for polio. My parents probably had me vaccinated for smallpox and measles and all that before I was old enough to have a choice about it. So it is what it is.
Well, I got my vaccination, and one of the reasons I did is because I cannot wait to go see live music, you know?
Ah, well, I don't know. I could change my mind any time. So my wife and I have been in discussion about if we can't get food or gas or none of that stuff to survive without getting a vaccination, I'm going to go to the farm. I know how to kill my own food. I know how to grow my own food. I know where water is. I can find that.
Wow.
If they want to come and shoot me, they can come and shoot me. Fine.
You're ready. Okay.
I'm ready. But I'm one of 60% that hadn't been over. I think 43%, they said. Yeah. They said. I don't know what the percentage is. They said 43% has been vaccinated. That's great.
Yeah.
I love it.
So tell me what...
And like, I know that... Go ahead.
When you, if you drive to the supermarket or you know, you're driving around, do you play music in your car? What are you listening to?
Sirius Radio. I have three channels I listen to, unless there's a golf tournament. I have Margaritaville, and I push a button. That's the first one. The second one would be Blues Junction, which is BB King station. And I have all of the other access to them, but I have Bluegrass Junction on. And that's the three I go back and forth and listen all the time. And I have a comedy channel. I have a news channel. That's the first three. There's six in my car on the Infiniti. And the last one, I'll have Soulville USA on, or I'll have PGA Tour if there's a tournament going on. And, you know, every now and then I'll listen to the Elvis channel and the Tom Petty channel, and there's hundreds of other channels. You know, Johnny Cash has a channel. I think Willie Nelson has a channel. Who else has a channel on that? There's 50-something channels that you can go to.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the Beatles have a channel. It's played nothing but Beatles music. And the reason I work with Jimmy Buffett. I know a lot of those songs. Some of the new ones I have not heard, and they're pretty good. But if you go on that channel, Margaritaville, you're going to hear a lot of reggae, and I love reggae because it has a great beat and a great feel. I don't care about the political lyrics. It doesn't mean that much to me. It's okay if they're singing them. Fine. That's great. But that's not why I listen to it. I listen to it because it has a good beat to it. So I think some of the songs you talked about, and I analyzed it over and over, and finally, I think in 2018, I might have come up with the idea. I said, you know, I finally figured out Stax Records. We were putting out instrumentals with words.
That's genius, yeah.
One way of looking at it. Yeah. You know, today's music is weird, and so a song would come on that's a big hit, and I'd start singing another song. And my wife would say, we should stop doing that. I said, I just want you to know where it came from. So now they got hip to that. So they don't use one song. They use 25 songs. It's two bars of this, two bars of that, two bars of that. Get out of here.
Yeah.
And I love it when the melody on top is the same as the melody that's in the past somewhere. And who is that guy? Something Richards. Is it John Richards? Has Let's Drink. Have you heard that one?
Uh-uh. Don't know that one.
He says that some of the lyric in the chorus says, let's drink, raise your glass, make a toast to the days that are in our past. We never talk about the bad. We've had a lot of fun. We are a long way from done. That's the first half of it. The second half, it says, let's drink, raise your glass, because wherever we go, that's where the party's at. We never talk about the bad. We're a long way from done. We've had a lot of fun. We're a long way from done. And that just blows me away. I said, yeah, there's a new song that'll last. So there was one playing one day, and somebody said, you know, that's a number one record. I said, good. I'll give you $5 for every note you can hum to me after this is over with. And they couldn't do it. I said, okay. I knew I was going to save money on that deal.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that one of my own songs. They might sing the whole damn song to me.
You go broke, yeah. Have to sell some of those sealed records of yours to pay your debts. Tell me, are there tracks you worked on over your career that you know, that are just your personal favorites? What are they?
I don't know. I don't have any personal. They're all good. But there's one song that Otis did I always thought was a bigger record than it became. It's Nobody's Fault But Mine. Hmm. And it's a little complicated, but it's a fun song. And I always love what the guitar did on that song.
Sure, yeah.
And I've had a lot of fans come up during Booker T's concerts and said, you know, I like your sound. I love what the lick you played on so-and-so. I said, I have to tell you and apologize to you. I don't remember it because I played on hundreds of songs since then. Not two or three, hundreds of songs. But I'll tell you this. You bring me the record, I bet you I'd figure out what I played. And I'll still stick with that. I don't know if I could or not.
Your career is mind-boggling. The number of folks you've played with and of great records that you've played on or acts that you've had something to do with, yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing. I want to hear that new track, the title track from Fire It Up.
Yep.
Yeah, you tell me nobody was in the same room who we hear on this record?
Nobody in that band was in the same room at the same time except John Tiven and myself.
Yeah. That's great. That's mind blowing.
And I'm gonna really blow your mind now. When you listen to the album, every vocal on that album was done through an iPhone.
What?
What? Really? Everybody goes, what? Yeah. Even my own engineer says, we were listening to some playbacks of some songs we mixed that morning, went to lunch, came back, we're listening to them in the car. He says, I can't believe he sang that all those through an iPhone. I said, me neither.
Things have changed.
Technology has changed. It's sad for this record that's not the number one push. It used to be years ago. Now they're all about make your home movies, and you can edit them just like Hollywood. And that's their big push right now. Hmm. They kept saying they had a good phone microphone in the phone itself. Now we've proven it.
I guess so, yeah. I got to let you go. We've gone over our time, and I do appreciate you you sticking
That's
with me.
Fine.
These are just such great stories. And what you mentioned a book. Is there a book coming?
Well, yeah, we don't know when. Nobody knows. I'm publishing this, so the album's already out. But I'm in the middle of doing interviews for this album, and I do a Zoom thing every Friday for the book. And the book publisher over in Europe, they charge people so much to log on to see and hear the Zoom, which is fine. Hmm. And hopefully that'll stop one of these days. I've been doing that now for about a month. And then the guy I'm writing a book with had to take hiatus of one, and I was out of town this last Friday. So it's been, we'll do one this Friday. It'll be 2 weeks we weren't doing one. So
So you're chipping away at it.
A little at a time. We have to have everything turned in by July 1, I think. So they want to be able, they want the option to put it out by Christmas if they have time. So we don't know. It may come out in 2022. We don't know. We'll just see. Same thing with Mascot. Wanted this record out by last Christmas. Wanted it done. So we did it. We had it all finished and mixed by last Christmas. And I said, that's a little late to be putting out a record. And I'm so glad they waited till now, because people are, we didn't, and I don't think when we were doing this, nobody knew that the lockdown would go any further past the, you know, whatever it was in January, but it did.
Yeah.
And so they're going to let it back open by July 1, so people can have the friends over and barbecues July 4th. So that's the word I've got. I hope so. I think that'll happen.
I agree, yeah. I hope to see you on the road this year, and whether you got to get your shot or not, or something, one way or another.
It doesn't matter, yeah. Mm. So we'll figure out something to make it work.
All right.
Steve, get it or not. So.
Let's hear this track here. It's the title track from a brand new Steve Cropper album, Fire It Up. What an honor to talk to you, man. Thanks for hanging out.
My pleasure. You bet. Glad to do it. Let me know how it comes out. All right. WFMU. All right, bye.